Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Thank you for being here and checking out this interview. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 329, my talk with UK improviser Chris Mead. But first, let's talk about Audible, shall we? Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to get your account today. Audible is a great resource for new books, podcasts, and other cool audio content. You're about to be on a plane traveling to your family out of town. Listen to a book on Audible during the trip. Maybe you'll be home with lots of family and you'll need an excuse for alone time in the middle of it at one point. Listening to a book on Audible is a great way to spend those moments. Audible has hundreds of titles and shows to choose from, all included in your membership. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up for your account today. So now let me tell you about my guest for this week. In this episode of Yes But Why, I connected with UK-based performer and teacher of improv, Chris Mead. Chris is a big deal in European improv circles, and I was really excited to get a chance to chat with him. Listen in as we talk about developing characters, building arts communities, and finding your creative focus. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 329, Chris Mead and the Magic of Producing Theater. Enjoy! I'm Amy Jordan, and this is
Yes But Why.
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 This is the Yes But Why podcast.
I can remember we had reams of like old printer paper that used to be attached together and have the sort of the holes down the sides.
Right.
And there would be reams of that, which my dad had printed out on one side, but I would have the back of it to draw on and write. And I would write these whole worlds, really, like superhero worlds. I would work out everyone's, the team and the superheroes and what their powers were and stuff. And I'd write them all down like a fact file and draw pictures of them. And then you could then tear them off and hand them to my friends, so we would like create groups. I remember I would sort of sit in the back of church doing that, and then afterwards we'd be like, right, here's what we're playing today, here's everyone's character. So yeah, it was a lot of I wrote and directed my friends in play, essentially.
Were they into it, or, you know, was everyone like, okay, I hear what you're saying about how he's got this, but what if also, or were they just like, I'm invisible and I'm also allergic to cheese, got it, no problem.
I think more that my sister always wanted to be able to talk to animals, so I always made sure that she could talk to animals. That was her favorite power to have. And then she would try and talk to like the cat or something, and it would be a cat and just wander away. But yeah, no, I think I did have that thing where I kind of took over and took charge, but mostly people seemed to be okay with it at the time. I look back horrified now, but I had all these worlds that I had inside of me that I wanted to show people.
No, so that's that important to do. Yeah, no, not everybody has that level of creativity inside them. You're helpful, you know. We get embarrassed because we end up running in circles where tons of us have the same skill. And so you're like, oh God, I know that you know how to make a character. I won't tell you. But the rest of the world, they don't know. They're not the people that they're happy to be told, like, oh well, see, but the thing is, and as long as you're not bossy about it, as long as they're not like, I would rather have this power, and you're like, no, this is the power you have, then I think it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the accept and build, you say an idea and I will be inspired by it and say my idea afterwards, part of me is now horrified at that. But yeah, I think at the time, you know, it was a starting point. It was a jumping off point. It only had that to it. Everyone had their power factor. I think I liked, do you have trump cards? Oh, that's a terrible name now, but we used to call them trump cards. where you would have characters on the cards and it would say age, strength, intelligence, and have a numerical value for each of those, and you'd play them against each other. I think that's where my character sheets were based on.
On that game. That makes me think of, like, magic cards and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. It was an early version of that.
Yeah.
So I'd say, oh, I've got Optimus Prime, I've got strength 9, and you would say, oh, I've got Starscream, he only has strength 5, so you win my card.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. That's video games now. I heard a child telling my, I was watching my kid play with another kid, and he was like, I'm going to use this yellow sword. It's got strength 5. And my kid's like, well, I'll use this red sword. And he's like, that's a shame because that's only strength 3. And my kid doesn't play video games, so he doesn't know. He's like, okay, great. Well, I'll hit you twice then. Like, he's like, he like just was like, sure, that sounds good. It's funny, the framework of that. Like, if you're not familiar with it, you're just sort of like, sure, strength 3, okay. Whatever that means. I get you.
I guess I'll lose.
You're like, all right.
I can remember one specific game, now I'm thinking about it, that I would like to study insects. So I'd be like an explorer. And we had a picnic table in my garden. And we would cover that picnic table in a big blanket to make a tent. And then I would have lots of beakers and, I mean, it would just be glasses from the kitchen, and try and put caterpillars and things in there and study them with a magnifying glass. I was very good, though. I know some children would try and burn insects using the sun and magnifying glasses. I really would just use mine to look closer at the mini beasts. Yeah. So I also did some of that. I was also a man of science.
Yeah, absolutely. You were interested in the caterpillar characters as well as the superhero characters. Hey, who knows what sort of lifestyle they live down there? You know, you gotta check them out and see what's going on. You know, he's got a whole caterpillar family, and you know, maybe he's the head of the caterpillar. Everyone loves him. He's the guy who tells everyone which movie to watch. So they go, oh, this guy, he's Uncle Caterpillar. He's the best. Then
I would separate Uncle Caterpillar from his family in a glass beaker for hours on end.
Sure. Did you return them, or did you like keep them in the glass and then they die? Because I did that with a lot of sea creatures when I when I was growing up. I had a lot of jellyfish that went away in a coffee can.
No. I would empty them out at the end of the day, because obviously the tent was taken down and I didn't bring them into the house or anything. They went back from whence they came.
I'm sure your mother appreciated that. As opposed to, like, she opens the cabinet later to get a drink and glass, and all of a sudden it's like, ah, caterpillars.
Some games definitely came into the house. I remember I like Roald Dahl. As a British kid in the 80s, Roald Dahl was a thing to read. And there's one, a lesser known one, called George's Marvelous Medicine, where this boy called George mixes all the household, like, shampoos and chemicals and all the kind of household liquids into this medicine. If I remember rightly, I think he's trying to kill his grandmother, because that's very Roald Dahl.
Classic.
Or get rid of her in some way, but it makes her really big. She grows and grows. So I liked to mix all the things in the house. And I wouldn't ever give it to anyone, but I like to do that. Once I tried to bake cakes by just taking everything out of the baking cupboard, just combining it all together. I remember it was bright pink. Like, shockingly bright pink, and it didn't rise at all. So I would just cook things, just bake, but with, you know, just off the top of my head, just improvised baking. Because baking as an art form, as a practice, it's really good to just improvise recipes.
You can wing it.
You don't get the best results by sticking exactly to measurements and stuff. It's I think that to wing it is really the best way to do baking, isn't it?
Certainly by taking everything out of the cabinet and putting it together and hoping there will be some sort of rising scenario.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the idea that you are aware of the rising as well. I was like, I don't even think I was aware of rising until I became an adult and someone was like, do you know how to make a loaf of bread? And I was like, I don't. I should probably figure it out. Like,
I think I maybe compared them to my mum's offerings and it was a bit like, these are much bigger and fluffier than mine, which look like a hockey puck.
You're like, who wants to try my cookies? And everyone's like, ooh, nope.
Throw them across the room where they're embedded in a wall because they're so dense.
Stayed there until they sold the house. And then and then that was the contractor's problem. Oh, man, I think about that kind of stuff, about, like, little children, like, destroying little sections that, like, then you know, you're just like, well, we'll deal with that later. And then, like, 20 years pass and it doesn't work out. I drove my dad's car into the garage when I was 8 and it hit the garage door and cracked it.
Of course.
And they did not fix the crack in the garage door until I was 38. So 30 years later, they fixed the door. And I was like, well, it's a good timeline, guys. Good job.
It's so interesting. So my mom and dad, they bought a house when they first got married. They never moved. So the house was about, I don't know, about 15 doors down from where my dad was born. So he wasn't born in a hospital. He was a home birth. And he bought the house about 15 houses up when my mother and him were married. And they stayed there their whole lives. And they just moved out a month ago.
Wow.
So they had their first house move, the first buying a house and having to move somewhere, you know, dealing with delivery companies, working out how mortgages work now. So that's crazy, right? I've had more experience than they have of moving. But yeah, I'm incredibly lucky that I had access to my childhood home all the way into my 40s.
Yeah.
But then packing up that place and seeing all these things, like we went into the attic, you know, went into the eaves of the house and took out everything in there. And there was this sort of chest, like waist-high chest, that I had drawn a TARDIS onto, the Doctor Who time machine, the TARDIS. I'd drawn windows onto that so that I could travel in time and stuff. And I just found all of this stuff. Yeah, it was really interesting to revisit my childhood as we packed it all up.
Yeah.
For the last time.
Yeah, how'd they do? Like, that's packing a lot of stuff. Like, I feel like we as a generation are much more attuned to moving. Like, I'm sure you and I have had multiple homes, not like that we've owned necessarily, but like move from this place to that. I've moved a bunch, like, so I understand what it's like to get rid of stuff. But yeah, my mom last year as well moved out of the house that I grew up in, and like the packing was insane. How did they deal with it? How did your parents like adjust?
They're very I'm very artistic and my emotions are very near to the surface. My mom and dad are very calm, very gentle, they've got everything. Nothing phases them at all. I'm the dramatic one. And everyone else in the family is just on an even keel. So they were just brilliant. It worked really well. It was fine for them. Not to talk so out of school a little bit, I'm just going to tell you the finances of it because it amazes me.
Oh, sure.
When they bought the house, they bought it back in, I don't know, when would it have been? Sometime in the 70s. I think they bought it for about £9,000. And they sold it for around £450,000.
Oh, my God. What an investment.
Yeah. But of course, that money can only buy you one house again.
Yeah.
You know, it's not actually any profit, but just it's so weird, isn't it?
It's an insane inflation that that those numbers are somehow similar over the years. It's like, and in 40 years, 9,000 becomes 450,000. Like, are you kidding? That doesn't seem right.
I don't think the amount our salaries have increased that amount.
That'd be great, though, for your parents who were like, well, I was making $10 an hour, and now I'm making $450,000. It's really great. I mean, I'm loving this paycheck I get, right? Yeah, I mean, if only it would work that way. No, it is wild. That is insane. Now, the places that they moved to now, have you visited? Does it feel like a new place? Does it have new stories already?
Yeah, I mean, so they've just really moved in, and I was up, a couple of weeks ago. Doing all the standing on ladders part of the equation.
Nice.
My dad has got this thing in the new garage where there are beams across, and he's calling it his sub loft. And there's he's like, yes, old chap, we'll just use all of these beams. They'll be my sub loft, and we'll put up things that we don't need so much. So your mother's sketchbooks and all of my tools I don't use very much. And so he's balanced these big boxes that can stretch between two beams all the way along the garage, and he set up his little work studio there. He bought a lathe when he retired, so he makes table legs and bowls and things. But all of these things are just teetering or in his sub loft above him, so I had to go and put all of those things up and check that they wouldn't fall down on him.
That's good.
But it's a lovely place. It's much smaller. It's really, you know, a space for two people who are getting into their 70s.
Sure.
Still got a lot of life left to live, but don't need five rooms for the kids anymore. So it is weird. And they moved up near my sister in a beautiful town in the UK called Warwick, which has a big castle. It's a sort of historic walled town. It's really beautiful.
Cool.
So I see the memories that are yet to be the future memories. I think they'll be really happy there, and it's really nice. My sister's like a 5-minute walk away, so their grandchildren are there too.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's lovely.
Now I get that they're even keel. They're like easygoing. They've lived. They're pretty calm about stuff. But like, what was the so you've been in this one space where they had this house for a long time. When you moved out of that house, when you were old enough to move out and go on your own, what was your like first new place? What was the way in which not reject necessarily, there's a bad connotation. I think when you leave your parents' house, you go and live a life that you're like, it's different from what I've lived. Let me find this new place. What was your like breaking out location? What did you do when you moved out for the first time?
The first time I moved out, I went to work at a Christian youth center.
Nice.
So it was this place that had people come, and I was on the sort of staff there. It wasn't quite volunteer. We were paid to be there. We were called the community team. So I spent time there. We had 40 beds. So I would be
cooking. Oh, you lived there too?
Lived there, made all the beds, you know, twice a week. Normally you'd have different church groups coming in and out, helped in the kitchens, and then led all the sessions. And the sessions, my favorite ones were we would do something called Theatre Week, where people would arrive on the Friday and immediately be auditioned for a musical, like a full musical. And then we would have 5 days to put together the entire musical and perform it. We would then go around the villages in the area, and they had like a nice rig of lights that you could break down and move from church hall to church hall, essentially. So we would do Barnum and Jesus Christ Superstar and a Return to the Forbidden Planet. West Side Story, I think we did once. That was pretty amazing to to arrive on a Friday, audition, and then just start learning lines and start choreographing and doing music. And I think that was really... so I used to go to that as a participant, and that's why I wanted, when I moved out, I wanted to deliver that stuff rather than be part of it. Because I think that was the moment. I wasn't a sporty kid in any way. I was a theatre kid, but we didn't have a huge amount of opportunity and to do plays and stuff. You know, there was one a year, and everyone in the sixth form would get all the main parts. And those of us in the younger years, we would get, you know, the small parts in the shows. You know, you do Midsummer Night's Dream and you would be the fairies. You wouldn't get to be the lovers or the kings and queens. Although I did get to be Puck, I would say. So I did manage to get around that by actually getting quite a good Puck. So I remember I was in silver. I was head to toe in silver, and I was on a skateboard, which I'd never learned to skateboard before that. So I learned skateboard to be Puck in the Midsummer Night's Dream. Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
I feel like we all get these skills, though, is like the only way I ever figured out how to do this is because I had to do it for a part. Like, it's whatever door you need to go through to learn new things. Like, it's like, oh, well, I didn't learn any new languages, but then I had to be this Portuguese character, and so I learned Portuguese. And you're like, oh, okay, wow, good for you. Like, yeah, whatever way gets you through to, like, cool knowledge, you figured out how to do the you know, skateboarding, even if it was a part, who cares? It sounds good. Plus, like, it sounds really fun to be like, I learned how to skateboard when I was Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream. Yeah. It's like, oh,
thanks,
yeah.
For it. I have this really visceral memory of falling off and scraping my knee. So I had sort of
classic
a bleeding
Puck
knee. And the school nurse was also doing the makeup for the show, so she looked at it, cleaned it, and then just got a sponge and put silver on the top, like just over the top of the greys. And I was, oh, okay, show must go on.
Yep
still remember picking out bits of silver paint from my wounds for the next few weeks.
She's like, this is fine.
Yeah, this is fine. You can't see it. It's going to be fine.
Don't worry. It's a disinfectant paint.
It was not. It was, certainly was not. But I think I was saying that. So that was my one time every year to do theatre. And the rest of the time I was an awkward theatre geek with really no one that in school that I really connected with. Then I would go to these theatre weeks, which would be 30 kids who were all that in their school. So it was a sort of national resource center. And suddenly it was like being the captain of the sports team. You know, it was suddenly I went from an environment where the things that I was good at counted for nothing. I was also at an all boys school, a sort of grammar school. And then suddenly for a week I was in this place where A, there were girls, which was a change, and B, everyone cared about the stuff that I cared about and valued the stuff that I was already good at. It was a complete transformation for me. It was where I found my people. And so, yeah, that's why when I first moved out, I went to help do that for other people because it was so important to me.
Now, is this summer camp?
Well, it was all year round, but the summer had a lot of these theatre ones in it. Because that was when people had a whole week off. I think even when I was working there, though, and they were doing Jesus Christ Superstar, I was like, maybe I'll just audition to be Herod in this. And they were like, what? And, well, it's like, you know, it's just one song in the second half. I'll just be Herod, and then we'll just facilitate everyone else except for that. So yeah, I still got a part even when I was ostensibly working there.
Yeah, so you gotta be pretty good though if you're getting Puck and Herod. Like, these are not you know, tiny parts to shake a stick at. That Herod song, good one.
Here's the thing: I got the comedy relief part, or always essentially. And I'm not a great singer. I can hold a tune. But Herod has got this great thing where the whole second act of that show is just deep, unremitting misery as we go towards the crucifixion. And there's just that one funny, good song halfway through the second act. And it's such a gift, that part. And I played him as a Bond villain, so in a suit with a white cat and backup dancers and things. So I got to kind of turn around in my chair and be like, Mr. Christ, which was really fun. And I remember very distinctly that when we went into dance routine, I threw the white cat prop off the stage as we went into high kicking mode, and someone was on a microphone going meow as it ran off. It was really fun. So yeah, I always got the stupid non-dramatic comedy relief part in stuff. Everything that I ever got was that. Really,
I was like, you say that with such a negative flair. I'm like, these are the best parts. What do you mean? You get to be the fun guy. You get all the laughs. Like, it's the key.
Yeah, I did love it. I did love it. But obviously, you always want to do the thing that you don't. You're always amazed by the thing that you don't do naturally. Like, oh, okay, well, I can do that stuff, so I don't value it because I can naturally do that. But this, yeah, these dramatic or the romantic scenes or those things, I didn't know how to do, and so they seemed more magical, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I get that. You mentioned that in this scenario, this is where you found your friends. Did you continue? So you went back there later on to, work there. And like you said, provide the experience to other people because you had such a good time. Did other friends of yours return to help as well? Was it like the whole crowd that was working there were like former campers that were like enchanted?
Yeah, a lot of it. And then the center was closed down. Just because I came from a very liberal church, like a very right on, like incredibly lefty liberal church, and unfortunately that's the church that doesn't stay. You know, it's the kind of evangelical, more right wing kind of churches that were the ones that were popular. All of us bleeding heart liberals, unfortunately, those churches just faded away. So there wasn't any money for it anymore. But me and my friends, we just kept that one event going, the Theatre Week event. So even into my 20s, we would then put that on. We would just find a place to do it. You know, the event was bigger than the centre. It was sort of the heart of that. And so, yeah, we did it for another 10 years or so. So I directed those shows. And I will say, once I was in my 20s and directing the shows, I didn't put myself in them anymore.
Well, sure. You had a lot of work to do.
Yeah. I let the kids actually do, you know, have the spotlight. So I did mature a little bit. But yeah, we put it on for another 10 years. And once again, my sister, you know, was there. She did all the props, all the costumes, worked out where everyone was sleeping. You know, she was an incredible producer role, essentially. She had no interest really of being on stage, but she did all that. And yeah, so many of my things, my sister's sort of there in the background, just making it all happen and doing all the kind of beautiful things. So, you know, she would make custom name badges for everyone and put their names on the door where they were sleeping, all these little beautiful things that made kids who were going away from home, I don't know, they were like 14, 15, 16, but sometimes it's hard to leave your parents for a while. So those are the things that made it special.
Those tiny little details totally matter. And it's great you're giving her that credit for it, to like, she brought some great magic to that experience.
It's the things that when I was that age and that someone was doing that, you didn't even think, oh yeah, someone's put a name on the door and look at that it's in the shape of something that's relevant to the play that we're in. Like those little thoughtful things, you just think, oh, they just happen, right? But no, they do not. Someone has to stay up till 1 in the morning making 40 of them and making sure they get put up before people arrive and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's lovely.
So even essentially, yeah, even like right in beginning of my 20s, I was essentially running a little theatre company. I mean, it was a theatre company that operated for 1 week, but it was pretty amazing. I really loved doing that. And I do think the whole improv thing, obviously doing something in a week, turning it around in a week, finding ways to because we didn't cut it, right? We just did the whole show. And young brains just are able to, you know, if you're not doing anything else, if you live and breathe the show for a week, you can get up to speed. We didn't get prompted very often. We were able to learn everything, all the choreography, all the lyrics, all the book. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
To know that was possible. And yeah, so I think that was a big formative memory for me.
Absolutely, for real. Especially this like huge, like week-long show that you're producing. Is it like once a year or like two a year? How many of these week-long shows are you doing?
It was once a year to begin with, but once we were free of the center and were administrating it ourselves, we would often do two a year. Man. Because we loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if your focus, like you said, if you can just put all your focus on that, you know, and sometimes when you're younger, the sort of weight of having a job and doing other things isn't quite so heavy on your shoulders. So it's easier to develop those kinds of things. Like, yeah, absolutely. I did 1,000 little plays that paid me nothing all over the, you know, all over every city that I ever moved to. And it's like, how did I spend all that time? What was I doing? But there's a time in your life when, you know, you can really soak into it. And if you don't have time to soak into it and be the director and producer, like you and your sister were putting in, I'm sure, hundreds of hours to make the whole thing happen. But just that week, all you have is 1 week. Don't worry. These beautiful people have put together the whole thing for you and they're really organizing it. Like that's amazing. I love being on both sides of that. Like I love being the people who are like, you know, making the name things and putting them up and knowing that when they all show up, they'll be excited, or being the person who's like, ooh, I can't wait to see what they've done. I'm going to arrive and be there for 1 week and experience whatever magic they've put together for me. There's just something really lovely about that.
And, you know, when I was in it, it was long enough ago that so people came from all over the country to do it. And then we didn't have social media and we didn't have mobile phones. We had landlines, but they often were places where you couldn't really talk to your friends. So we became letter writers. That was the other thing. We just all wrote to each other throughout the year because that was the best way. So I have, you know, I went up to my loft to try and tidy up a few months ago. I have boxes of one side of this correspondence with all of these friends that I had. And it was magical because I grew up in the southeast of England, to Essex. So I didn't know anyone who was northern. I didn't know anyone from Manchester or Liverpool or from you know, Wales or another country, but obviously attached to ours, like from Cardiff or Scotland. And then suddenly got all these friends and we kept the Royal Mail in stamps and postage for a long time. We had multiple friends and we would always talk. So that was pretty amazing. The last gasps of physical letter writing was also something that was intrinsic to that experience for me.
That's so nice. I like that for like a writing, from like a writing perspective. And then also even from like, you know, the artist's way where they say to do like writing pages every day, there's something to having your, like you're writing a letter to your friend and you like take time out of your day to like put a little bit down for them as you're writing them something, like just the act of writing, whatever you're writing, even if it's like, oh, this thing is broken and all day long I've been dealing with this thing, like just writing it out and then sending it to another person. There's something so, it's a level of magic that's fun.
To connect. I think nowadays, you know, if you go look at emails, you can still have these things, but you can see your side of it because they'll be in the replies. For me, I look at these letters and I'll have someone say, thank you for your advice on that thing. I really appreciate it. And I'd be like, what advice did I give? I only have your side of it. I don't remember this, and I don't know. Yeah. What would 14-year-old me, what advice would he give anyway? Because he knew nothing about anything.
Man, now I feel like the letters are just writing prompts. Like, they're like, try to figure out what the letter was that this is a response to, and like, yeah, write that. Though the other part of me is like, dude, call these other people and get the letters and make a little camp journal to send to everybody, like a little back and forth about, hey, remember when? That's so fun. Yeah. Are you still in connection? Like, do you still connect with them? Did you find them on Facebook?
There's a few. It's quite hard. I think, yeah, we were so spread out, so we weren't sort of in each other's life. Once the event stopped, then we couldn't really, we couldn't meet up. There was one guy who really good friends with, and he was in my first improv team. So when we got to that bit, we kept going. So he was sort of my big connection. And obviously my sister and my family, there were people who were in it that were, my mum and dad got dragged into it as well, painting. I think my dad constructed a spaceship for Return to Forbidden Planet and stuff.
Oh, nice.
I read this great article about friendship and how you have to look at the people you know. We can only hold about 100 people in our heads actively, sort of like, I wonder how those people are. And if you re-remember someone, you lose someone else. And if you think of that, those 100 people as ranged over a mountain, the people at the peak of the mountain, so standing that very small amount of space at the peak of the mountain, they're your best friends, your closest friends, the people that you have the most time for. And then sort of down the slopes, just a little way down, are the people in your close acquaintances, your good friends. And then further acquaintances right down to the people at the bottom who you only remember if they contact you or you see them randomly. And there was this nice idea that sometimes the people at the top of the mountain aren't the people who are best for you. They're just the people who happen to be your friends at a time where you know they just stayed put, and sometimes you've grown apart. But by keeping them right at the top of the mountain, you're not letting people further down who might be better for you in the stage that you are now in your life. So you have to let them go so you can bring other people up to the top. And obviously, being an improviser now, we were talking before we officially started recording about having people all over the world again. And yeah, I do think you have to let some of those old ones go. So yeah, when I go to an improv festival, I get that same feeling of excitement, almost exactly the same feeling of excitement as I did driving up, knowing I was going to theatre week. The idea of, I'm going to meet a group of people and we're going to put on shows together, and shows that people don't think it's possible. So in Theatre Week, people didn't think it was possible that a group of kids could put on an entire West End length musical in 6 days. And nowadays, people don't think you can improvise an hour and a half dramatic narrative long form. So yeah, just knowing that I'm going to meet a group of like-minded people and do this sort of impossible artistic thing connects me so strongly to my 14-year-old self. And I find that such a gift that essentially, I guess, a lot of people moved on and they grew up and they had kids of their own, and they lost their chance to do that stuff anymore. They felt they had to grow up. And I feel like I'm doing exactly the best parts of my life from when I was 14 and just doing that all day, every day. So I find that, Yeah, I wake up every day and I have to pinch myself. I really do. The improv has given me this opportunity to continue almost exactly to do the things that lit me up as a kid. Yeah, I'm tremendously grateful.
I really think it's about your own choices in the way you want to live your life, though. You know, like in the same way, to go back to your example of the like friends on the mountain scenario, like perhaps that friend isn't good for you in some other way. Like they're not going to help me become the mechanical engineer I could be, but who knows to what they bring to your like state of mind that maybe helps you deal with whatever you actually have to deal with, you know, like, and I think there's many different kinds of people, but I think there are, when you're a theater person, when you're a person who goes from show to show, the ebb and flow of who are your focused friends, I think, changes. And yes, you have allowed yourself to accept that the time period of we get this 1 week and we get to be together and enjoy ourselves. And if I never see you for the whole rest of the year after that, we still had this moment, right? And it allows us to appreciate the smaller moments and the relationships that we get, even if they are only tiny, right?
Yeah. Some friendships are for a certain time and it does not make them worse friendships. They're just perfect for that time and that length of time. And I look at a lot of my Theatre Week friends in that way, in that, oh, they were incredible and changed my life, and you know, they were amazing, but that doesn't mean that they will be that forevermore. And that's fine, that's good. There's this lovely program on Disney Plus that I think not many people, it sort of came out and not many people checked it out, but it's called Encore. And what they did is they put back together high school musical casts, people who did things in high school, and then they just bring them back together as adults to restage parts of that same musical in the same roles. I cry every episode. I cry because I think of those people and the shows that we created and the things that we shared. And I just don't know where any of them are now, but I think of them with great affection, and you know, I hope they're doing brilliantly.
Yeah.
I think they would be happy and probably unsurprised to know that I am still doing the same sort of stuff, because I was really into it. I think I was demonstrably more into it than most of them. I would think most people are like, yep, that tracks for Chris. He's still doing that stuff. He's found a way.
Do you think that you were always, I'm going to use the word destined, but let's pretend, like quotes, destined to be this like theater lifer, or like creating this stuff? Do you think you were always going to do that? Or do you think there were decisions or moves that you made in your life that like, where you said, I refuse to do this other thing, I am going to do this theater, I'm going to make this decision? Or did it feel like just the natural flow of your life, and you're like, of course I'm doing this. This is like the way you think of your friends thinking of you is like, oh, of course. And I feel that same way about people. If I met people who I knew when I was in 10th grade, they'd be like, oh, of course, that's what you do. But like, they don't really know your full journey. You know your full journey. Do you think you like had to decide and make a decision to do it? Or did it just flow and you're like, and it's exactly the way it's supposed to be? How did it feel for you?
So my mom said, I could never see you in an office job. Right from a very young age, I could see you weren't going to do that. But the fact is that I did have an office job for 16 years. So I did theatre all the way up. I did theatre as my degree at university as well. And then after that, I went to Bangladesh on a trip, on a visit. And that made me, like, coming face to face with that level of poverty was crazy. It was like, I can't believe this is how it is in the world. But also, because you'd see on TV, when there was a famine or, you know, there would be a big appeal or something. But being there, what I was struck with was the other side of it, that this sense of community and the strength of the people that I met was the thing that knocked me out, really. So anyway, when I got back from that, I was like, oh, maybe I should work in charity and poverty eradication, that sort of area of things. And so theatre became something I did in the evening, you know, that I amateur dramatics and stuff like that. So that was really the way I thought my life was going to go. And I joined a international, what we'd call an NGO, a non-government organization, that helped with poverty eradication and flood preparedness, to natural disaster preparedness and that sort of thing. And I was a creative officer there. So I would write and make things. So I think in my time, I created an escape room that taught you about climate change, or I would build a VR experience that put you in the shoes of an internally displaced person. So I had quite a cool office job, I guess, making theatrical or creative experiences that tried to change the world. But then in the evenings, I would be in shows and things. And I guess the other part to it, so I'm jumping backwards and forwards, is in university, when I was at the Edinburgh Festival doing a show, the people that were on after my show in the student venue just happened to be Baby Wants Candy and the original cast of Baby Wants Candy, who are all improv legends. And they had forgot to bring anyone to tear tickets for them, so they had no front of house. And I was on, they were on immediately after us. So I watched the first show, and I don't think this is me rewriting it in my mind. I'm pretty sure that when I saw that first long form musical improv show at the highest level, you know, the original Baby Wants Candy, it was like Al Samuels and who else was in that original club? Well, you'd have Jack McBrayer, and it was a pretty amazing cast of people. My head exploded, and I was like, this is what I want to do. This exactly. My brain is made to do this. I can't really remember. I'm not great with scripts. I always do different things every night and annoy everyone else I'm on the stage with. I want to do this thing. I didn't think this was possible. Now I know it's possible. This is all I want to do. And so I said, I will tear tickets for you every night for free if I can stand at the back and watch your entire 30-date run at the Edinburgh Festival, which is what I did. And then after that, that was, you know, I could do it. I could do improv in the evenings really easily and do shows at the highest level, really, because it was such a small community in London at that point that I was, you know, I was right up there doing it, and I would do every single thing. So, yeah, so yeah. Essentially did a 9-to-5, and then did improv in the evening. And I just got to the point where I started teaching and performing, where I did that every day. And I found that the improv sustained me and gave me energy. So I'd feel really tired at 5 o'clock when I finished at work, but as soon as I started improv, all my energy came back, and I was in my 20s. So I also had more energy anyway. Eventually just got to a point where I could stop doing the day job and do it, and I could sustain myself just doing improv. There was a point where, to answer your question in a hugely roundabout way, there was a point where I thought I was going to just do it as a fun thing in the evening, and not just, you know, that was really fulfilling and lovely, but it's even cooler to just orient your whole life around this art form that you adore. So I took the chance to do that. But it was never a plan. And there was a big period of time where I went into an office and sat in a computer every day.
It sounds like this office job was particularly creative, though. It doesn't it sound like you were an accountant and you were, they were like, here's some spreadsheets, try to find every time somebody spent 50 cents. Like, that's not what's happening to you. They're like, when you're like, I made an escape room to teach people, I was like, you're adorable. Like, you just found a day job that would let you make tiny shows. And those tiny shows turned out to educate people on the specific thing that you were working on. But at the same time, it was like, either you're teaching people how to do Midsummer Night's Dream, or you're teaching them how to understand, you know, famine. And it's the same sort of vibe. You're still creating shows. It's wonderful to see that, like, your wheels spun the same way, whether the story was fictional or non-fictional. Like, you're like, this is my skill. I'm happy to use it for you when I need to, but this is my skill. Like, this is what I know how to do, and I'm great at it. So how can I help?
I think people, I wasn't really like anyone else in the organization. Everyone else was these huge brain academic policy writers and activists and change makers. And I was a bit like a foundling elf that was just in the middle of it all, being like, I can make a show. Does anyone want me to make a show? That way, a lot of that time was like that.
Was this the early 2000s? I feel like there was a lot of creativity in business at that point. Like, they were trying for a lot of things that they don't really do much of anymore. But because I had a lot of day jobs like that too, where it was like, I work for this company, but my job is to create these fun parties that they have. Like, I don't know how this works, but this is what I'm doing. Like,
yeah. And there was this sort of thing where I don't really feel at the moment, but there's this lovely quote that the arc of the universe is long, but ultimately it bends towards justice. And I feel all through the 90s and the 2000s, like, we are getting better at this. There are groups of discriminated people who are now less discriminated against. We understand that, we understand more, we're getting better at serving communities that haven't had a voice before. Inch by inch, slowly, we are getting better. And that, so in around about 2005, there was this global thing called Make Poverty History, which was many, many organizations all around the world. There was like a white band that people wore, and it was like a big thing. Like, this is, we are going to, there's no reason why in this world some people have to be super poor and others are super rich. That's something that we've done. It's not like, oh, there's not enough resources for everyone. We've done that, and we are globally, we're going to try and stop it. We are going to try and reorient that. I don't feel that in the world anymore. Oh, I don't at the moment. So you were right that there was something in the 2000s that were like, we can really do this.
Because I was thinking about your job and how you had this job. And again, you mentioned that you were in your 40s. I'm in my 40s. So I'm like, okay, similar timelines, the vibe of this. But the other part is that the idea of being full-time as an improv teacher wasn't really a thing for a long time.
Oh, no. Because there were like 25 of us in the whole of the UK who were doing it.
Forget the whole of the UK, the whole of the world. There were like 10 people that were considered improvisers, and then everyone else was just like randomly took a class. Like, and now it's huge. Now it's like every major city has a large community, and all sorts of different people who've been doing it a long time. You know, some people who are like you, they want to direct. Some people like your sister who want to produce and create these worlds. Like, there's so many more opportunities, and the idea of how I think the pandemic helped this as well, is the idea of getting theater people to figure out how to run a business. Like that, because it's like we're discussing this idea of like, oh, my brain worked this way. This is what I brought to the table. Yeah, but when you're trying to run a theater, when you're trying to create this week-long festival, even if it's 1 week a year, that's a lot of administrative effort.
Oh, yes.
That like you don't, like you have to think about like, okay, where is a single, like when you were telling me how your sister like found places for everyone to sleep, it was like, whoa. Like just that alone, like even if you were just like, let's get a bunch of people to all stay in one area, not even what activities we're going to do, just like, how do we all get them together? Insane. Yeah. Right. So the fact that that happened, plus all this other artistic development, plus all of this like extra work that added the magic, like that's an effort, and not everybody's built for that. I mean, I was in stage management for many years, so like organization is my jam. I'm into it.
Yeah.
But not everybody is, you know, like they're not interested in being
the person who does it.
And yes, especially because in improv, a lot of people have decided that that means I don't like rehearsing or working on stuff. And I'm like, that's not actually what improv is, but you know, that's fine. Like, I'm cool with that. But just the effort, like it wasn't a thing. Like theater businesses that functioned well, that did well, the idea that you can right now run a business and functionally make money doing improv is real now. It was not real like a while back. And even as we mentioned earlier before we started recording, the idea that you have not only found a way to teach improv as a business that makes you money, where like that's your job, but you then pivoted during a time when every theater shut down in the world and found a way to do it online. And now your community is not just the people in the country and surrounding areas where you're at. It's everyone in the world. Yeah. Like, how did that change for you? You've been so organized. You made this your job. How does that feel to like have globalized your own efforts to bring theater to the world?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. So even before the pandemic, there's a very strong European improv festival circuit.
Yes.
So I'd begun to start meeting all of these people. And I always say this, the most incredible thing about improvisers is wherever you travel, your community is already there waiting for you when you land. And improvisers tend to be kinder and more thoughtful than regular theater people, who are already lovely people often. But that kind of I find that improvisers are even more so, because the art form, when practiced right, I think teaches you to be a more generous human being.
There was a competitive bent for sure.
Yeah, there's
a lot of competition in theater and film that pits people against each other, makes them not a team, but rather people who are all vying for the same thing. Whereas in improv, we can all have it. It's one well that we're pulling from, as opposed to like one guy gets a drink out of the well and the rest of us have to try to find a way to find out where the other water is. It lends itself to being more of a community-based thing, which is great.
And I know it's not perfect. I know there is a lot of problems. I really, I'm not rose-tinting it, but just in general, there is that there. And we've still got a long way to do and go, and I still think there's a lot to do. But yeah, there was this immediate thing. So Katie, my duo partner, Katie Shute, and I, we were thinking for a long time, we go to these places, we have an amazing time, but there's nothing. We then go, we'll teach a workshop and we'll get excited about the potential. And then we're like, bye, see you in 3 years when we're invited back to this place. And we wanted to have that continuity and a community that we could build. So what eventually became what firstly was called the Improv Place and then became the International Improv Station, which was essentially Facebook for just improvisers with online classes as well. That's the elevator pitch for it, an online improv and teaching community. We were going to do that before the pandemic, which was why we were able to do it so quickly when the pandemic happened. We were like, yeah, there should be a place where people can share knowledge, get taught, do distance learning and that sort of thing. So we were always thinking about that. And then the pandemic made it essential, because that was also the moment where I had given up my day job. So that was that exact moment. So I had all the energy in the world and wanted to do something. So we put that together and we made it a subscription service, which gave us a monthly income. And then we did classes on top of that. And then as we discovered all these brilliant other communities, like we can finally start diversifying so that all the teachers don't look and sound like us. And so then we met all these incredible improvisers from different backgrounds, and we're able to put them front and center. And it was just a great time. And we would do a thing called office hours, where every Friday we would say, we're online between 11 and 12 UK time. We're just going to sit here with a cup of tea, as British people do. And anyone who wants to come and talk about improv can. And we would get 20, 30 people turn up for that hour. And it was this thing every week. People would come from all over the world and talk about improv with us. And that was one of the sort of centerpieces of the community, over and above the classes. And then we'd do social nights where we'd all play ball games or, you know, silly games online together. And then we did an intensive, intensive where you would travel somewhere, just a small group of people who met every single day online in Zoom to be taught by other teachers and things. It was incredible, but it was definitely a business plan that only worked in a pandemic. I think we could have made it work afterwards, but we would have had to have stopped doing. We would have had to stop our in real life stuff to really concentrate on it. And we were quite excited to be in rooms again and be with audiences. And so we decided that we were going to shut it down while it was still strong, rather than let it sort of fade out. But yeah, the 2 years of the International Improv Station, as it ended up, was insane, and just a serendipity that we were already going to do it, and then we had to do it.
Yeah. There's something really fascinating about that, such that you guys had the idea before it became required. I feel like there's a lot of people, heck, even the people who made Zoom, were like, guys, this is a good idea. And everyone's like, all right. Sure. And then you're like, no, guys, for real. Like, I promise you, we've like made this work. It's gonna be good. And like, yeah, we'll see. And then all of a sudden it's like, everybody uses it. Like literally, not kidding. The week before, let's say the first week of March, 2020, I was at a podcast festival. And at that podcast festival, people were talking about how you should use Zoom to do interviews. And I was like, listen, Skype was invented.
You've got to be in the room. Yeah.
I'm fine. Like, I can do these interviews online. Like, I don't need this new app. Everyone's like, I swear it's the best app. I'm like, whatever. Sure. And then a week later, it was like, by the way, we're all using this. Get into it. And I was like, oh my God. So like, you just never know. And the idea that you had your finger on this pulse and then found a way to like take advantage of it while it was hot. Cause you're right. I think the idea of ending it before it like wore out its welcome, you know, because it was like, I was very excited for Zoomprov, and I still take online classes with Katie. But at the same time, the idea of it is less exciting than it used to be. So I love the idea that during this time that it was really needed. Really needed. Yeah. You found a way to come in there and be there for people in a way that, you know, it's almost like we've been talking about this whole time. It's short projects. It's little bits. We do this for a period of time. We get really close to the people that we're going to work with. And then it's over. And we're like, that was a good time. And this is what I learned from that. And this is how I can take that. And the only way any of us are going to progress is if we all separate again and then go off and do our own projects. Like, I'm sure people that took your classes were inspired to do other things. And people who taught with you were like, oh, I can do this. And now they're doing their own things. And like, you inspired all these other artists to create something that they wouldn't have thought they could do if not for the time spent with you. So it was a really great like snippet that you guys found. And like, excellent job taking advantage of, like I said, the like short term burst of excitement that theater life really is.
Yeah, discrete, time-bound projects, I think, are so important. And to make it a bit wider, a lot of improv groups, they do one show and they stay together until it either falls apart or they become famous. They just do that one show week in, week out. I really enjoy the model that I first... Well, I mean, I first did through amateur dramatics, you know, where you'd say, we are the cast of this show and we're going to rehearse for this many weeks and then we're going to put on a show for 2 weeks and then we will say goodbye and go and do other shows. That's like how acting has worked for a long time. But I don't notice it so much in improv. But then the Hideout Theatre in Austin, because it was a very big influence for me, and they would put on shows that were on for a while. You know, we put together this cast for this show and we'll present this improv show and then it will be gone. And I loved that because, again, discrete time-bound projects. And so for me, that's the stuff that I'm excited about. I do love being in a group that it will always be together, and my duo is very important to me. But yeah, I want to do a run of an improv show that explores folk tales and do that for a couple of weeks of performances, and then say, well, that was lovely to work together, and what's next? And then actually one of my shows that I do now is called Duologues, and that's essentially I find another improviser that I admire, and we present one show together as if we'd been a duo for 10 years. We sort of ask ourselves the question, what would our show be if we had a decade together? How would our two personalities have melded to resulted in a show? And without apology and without saying, actually, this is the first time we've been on stage together, we just present that show that has been informed by a pretend decade of being together. So I really enjoy this time-bound, we're doing this, and that's all we're agreeing to. We will put our heart and soul into it, and then we'll do something else. I've had too many improv groups slowly have the enthusiasm leach out of them to a point where people don't like it anymore and start arguing. I don't want to be in a group like that. I want to find people to inspire me and work with loads of different people. Yeah. So, yeah.
I feel like if art was better served by the sort of longer term, like everything's based on the lesson, I guess, that you're like trying to get out of it, right? Like, and so the idea of the longevity, some relationships are built for longevity. We've got to figure out how to do that. I work as a staffing manager, right? I give people jobs. I think about my thing as developing long-term relationships. This person's going to work for me in lots of different ways. Sometimes they're going to be great at the job and sometimes they're not, but that doesn't mean that if they're not good at the job, I'm going to toss them out. There's other jobs maybe they could do. So I need to develop this longer-term relationship with them and figure out how we can keep working together until one of us decides that we won't work together anymore, and then that's okay. But like, you're right, the improv thing requires a magic that is the excitement of it, the interest in one another. And also I find, and maybe it's just because I teach early level improvisers, there's something to the magic of figuring out each other. There's something to watching people on stage who have in front of you this moment of like, oh, I know what Joe needs in this. And then they give Joe the bit that they know he's going to be great at. And he's like, that was what I needed. And like, does it. And you get to see that whole part, the whole creation of it, the whole realization right there in front of you, as opposed to like, ah, same old, like, you know, it's
so interesting. Yeah. So many bits of my life is around this. How can I have this experience that has brackets either end of it that's bound, that I know when it's going to end so I can do something else? Right back to the Theatre Week things we've been talking about and the way I structure shows now and the kind of shows I want to do. That is so interesting. I've never really seen that. I you know, but until you can have a wide ranging conversation about where you are now and where you came from, I guess you don't see those things. But yeah, of course there's value in long-term friendships, people that know you better than anything. But like, there's this old improv maxim that if you want to become the best improviser you could be, you need these two poles. One pole is find a group of people that you love wholeheartedly and who love you and you get each other and always be together and make shows based on that deep mutual respect and knowledge of each other. And also find ways to be in completely new situations where you don't know the people, where you don't know what's going to happen, where you're outside your comfort zone. If you can hit both of those things, you're going to be a very good improviser. And for me, Katie, she's that. She's the longevity. And then I get to throw myself into these crazy situations and weird shows as well.
Yeah, it's important, I think, to have both of those. But I think it's also really fascinating that we get to a certain, like, as we get older, we develop different kinds of understandings of it. Like, even the group that you, even the show that you do now, where it's like you meet somebody and you discuss or you know, do some exercises to figure out, like, how would we meld together over 10 years? Even the discussion of that, the understanding of how people change over 10 years is a fascinating, like, thought experiment to have. Yes. With another person, to be like, okay, well, what would have happened? Like, yeah. I realized the other day that at an improv school, the two most dedicated groups are people in their 20s or people in their 50s. And the reason why is because in your 30s and 40s, there's a lot of tumultuousness. There's a lot of new decisions you have to make. Oftentimes other people, some your spouse, some your child, sometimes your parents, who you have to deal with in different ways. Mm-hmm. That, like, in your 20s, you're all yourself, all that is. And then, and like, that's it. You're just figuring out who you are, because that's your purpose. Like, you know, hey, 20 somethings, all you want, but that's all they have to do right now. They're just learning how to be adults. Let them figure it out. Then they have to be an adult in their 30s and 40s, right? But then you see, like, I have friends who I'm like, on my Facebook feed, like I said, it's all 20 somethings and 50 somethings. So I'm like, how is this person every week posting a monologue that they're working on? And it's like, oh, their kid left for college. Like, they're no. It's the other side. It's like my friends who I'm all like, how did he figure out how to get this thing together? Like, oh, he has all this open time now. Like, he's not like getting a kid to school anymore. Like, he's like, oh, I have all this stuff to in my brain that I can release now, and no one to walk through the door and say, like, hey, mom, I need this, you know. Like, that's the it's like different moments in your life when you have this freedom to explore your own self. And in improv, that's why I'm like, yeah, you can have your troupe, but don't try to stay in a troupe 30s and 40s. Do those short-term projects. Yeah, I was like, but 50 something troops, like, I'm not quite 50 yet, couple of years, we'll see how it goes. And then I'm like, hey, all right, who knows who the peeps might be, you know. And if, you know, you and I live in cities or areas where there's strong communities, you know, it's very possible that neither of us have met all of the people that do improv in our areas, right? And that's
not
great.
Anymore.
Like, I love the idea that, like, every time I meet a new person in Austin and I'm like, wait, you've also been doing improv for 13 years? What? How have we never met? Like, but that's great, because, you know, the world brought me a new friend through this whole thing. And it's like, how are we not best friends? Like, this is amazing. Now we can be friends now and find this new thing because we've had this experience. I don't know. I'm totally into appreciating the time that we spend, the effort we put in, and even the changes. Like, who am I now? I don't know. I'm going to figure it out. Like,
yeah, no, that is exciting.
It's cool.
And, you know, that makes me think that I've been doing improv long enough that I definitely could know everyone that did improv in 2009 in London, because there weren't that many of us. But now there is no way I know everyone that does improv. I couldn't, not even a fraction. How exciting to have been there the whole time as that community grew. That feels really special and such a gift as well. So yeah, I'm the same as you. I get excited when I meet someone like who does improv that I don't know. I'm like, how is that? This is incredible.
Yeah, you're like, oh, cool. What do you know? I want to talk about it. Yeah. That's why I'm so excited I get these. I get to set up these conversations where we're like, oh, what? You thought of that? That's amazing. Like, even just the friendship conversation that we've had during the course of this discussion, it's like, yeah, that's been on the tip of my brain. Like, what's adult friendship like? How am I doing it right? You know, and how does that all, you know, but it comes out. I find that if you're really listening to this podcast all the time, you probably totally know what I'm going through because I'm always directly talking about it. But at the same time, like, it's always filtered through, like, that's a cool point that you made. This is what it makes me think of, right? This like meld of ideas and like experiences. So interesting. So for you, you're in a new space, like you're creating something new. What are you jamming out to right now? What's the excitement that you're working on? Both what are you creating in the world? And then what are you taking in for yourself? How are you creatively filling up your cup?
Yeah, there's a bunch of really exciting things at the moment. One is I'm just starting doing classes here in my town of Farnham, which I think is really nice because it means I get to be a community builder as well as a teacher. And I'm making a lot of mistakes with that in terms of how to structure classes and courses and things. I immediately started applying the model in London to here with different courses for different levels of people. Whereas actually what I just need to do at the moment is have a drop-in and have it happen every week. And have it happen at the same time and not have it, yeah, and make it consistent. And that will build the community to a point where I can then go, okay, who wants to tell a story? Let's do a narrative course. Who's really interested in emotional connection and relationships? We can do that course. But we're not there yet. We just need to build that up. So this idea of just starting a school that's my school of improv in Farnham, where I can cycle to class rather than get on a train for an hour. That's something that's really exciting me at the moment. Online stuff still. I've really enjoyed partnering with other teachers and practitioners on online classes. So the big one I do at the moment is with a wonderful improviser and film critic called Tara Judah, and it's Improv Cinema Club. So we do these whole long courses where every week you watch a different film or the works of a different director, and then we work out how to improvise that way and discuss it and stuff. So it's like a film club, but interrogating through improv skills rather than just discursive stuff. So that's been really lovely. That really, I enjoy that, and I want to do that for some other disciplines and use that model of working with someone else who has real knowledge about, Tara will do lectures about things so we can learn more about it. That stuff I really love. I'm starting to write a book on improv that's going to be a bunch of short stories where the moral of the story is an improv learning. So like parables and fables where you sort of learn not to treat other people badly, or that you shouldn't talk to strangers, or whatever the thing is. But it will always be, you can accept and build on other people's ideas. Listening is a good idea. Try and build from something in your own life. So they're fun stories that are also improv lessons. So I'm writing that at the moment, which I'm really enjoying. And I'm doing that sort of collaboratively through my newsletter. There are people who are actually sponsoring me to do it and get the stories first and get to be able to sort of talk to me about them and help me edit them together. So that's really cool. Yeah, really enjoying that. Really finding time each day to write. And I've got very into habit creations of James Clear, Atomic Habits, and how to actually become better at that sort of thing. So that's really exciting for me. to really just sit down and write and make that time and make it habitual. There's one more thing that I was really, really excited about. Oh, virtual reality. So Katie and I are working with a brilliant company called Fanco, which is another couple of people, to try and work out how to do improv and virtual reality. And we've been very lucky to get quite substantial grants to do that, so we can rehearse and perform. And we've worked with some brilliant companies in Canada specifically who are creating what will be off the peg VR software, but we're sort of helping to change it so it can also be used for improv, as well as making our own. Oh, not me personally, but working with people that do. So yeah, what can improv be when you can actually change shape and change the world around you? And what does that do, opening up audiences who can just put on a headset and be fit 3D in the room, in inverted commas, with you, rather than watching on a Zoom screen or something that distances you from the show. You can be sitting right beside the person that's performing in virtual reality. So that's really exciting and feels like the beginning of something that we'll all be doing in 10 years and being sort of the very first people to be putting improv in that space, or one of the first.
Well, Chris Mead's got his finger on the pulse. I'm telling you, you knew Zoomprov was coming. We should start listening to you and your VR prophecies. I'm into it. I like me that. The way Zuckerberg, to bring ourselves together. Oh yeah, you and Mark, you're so similar.
Yeah, I really want to fix my cart to that horse. Mark Zuckerberg is universally beloved. Also, that is not the phrase at all, is it? Fix my horse to that wagon, something like that.
The cart to the horse.
You can't put the cart before the horse, and you can't lead a horse to water. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Don't hang out with Mark Zuckerberg, I think, is the final. I think that's what we're coming
just
to.
Don't link yourself with Mark Zuckerberg.
He's put himself, I feel like, speaking of carts and horses, he's just, all the horses, all the carts he gets around him, they're just not the right ones.
They're not the right ones.
You know, but they've got dollar signs on them, so he likes them. And they, hey, but there, if that's what you're looking for.
It's all about installed user bases. So I remember DVDs became really big because Sony put DVD players in every PlayStation 2. Mm-hmm. And PlayStation 2s were affordable enough that they got into a lot of homes. So consequently, DVD became a format of choice. And then during the pandemic, everyone needed a good camera. Everyone needed a good microphone. So the installed user base to be able to do Zoomprov was there. I think that once there's an installed user base for VR headsets, when they get small enough that you can put on a pair of glasses and have, and it's really, there's no barrier to entry, then of course we're going to start putting on shows in 3D spaces. It's going, you can sit at home and go and see amazing theatre. And improv, we're just much more, we're quicker on our feet. We're able to set up these things. We don't need to learn a script. We don't have to cast it. We can just go for it. So I think improv is really at the bleeding edge, or is potentially at the bleeding edge of performing in this way. And obviously we're not the only ones doing it, but I think we're really committed to it and we're doing a lot. So we're already on to like our third VR show, and we're presenting a fourth one early next year, as well as revisiting one of our favorite ones, which is called The Galaxical Implosions, and is a improvised sitcom set on a spaceship. lots of very awesome things happening that I think will be, there's a lot to, there's a lot to take up my time in 2023.
That's okay. That's what happens when you're freelance, when you're creating your own business. You got to hustle. You got 1,000 things. You got to keep all those plates spinning, for sure. You got it. What was the name of your theater in Farnham?
I haven't got a name yet.
Oh, no name. All right. So you're just going to scroll, just check every name that's out there just to make sure, and then find a new one. You're like, okay, well, let's see, what are other theaters named? Not that.
I had, I mean, I my favorite, I really liked Sonder. I had a theater called Sonder, and Sonder was one of those modern words that people append to. I think it was just made up pretty recently, but it means when you walk down the street and then you have that revelation that every single person has as complex an inner life as you do. And that's just mind-blowing, that every single person you see in the street has as much going on as you do, has many thoughts and feelings and interrelationships. That's the concept of Sonder, that we all contain multitudes, but so does everyone else, which I thought was a lovely name for an improv theater. But then, of course, you look it up and there's about 30 theaters called Sonder.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I'm just learning this word for the first time, and there's 30 theater people that have already created their. Wow, that's pretty amazing. Yeah. I was like, that's wild. I do appreciate that idea, though, and what a deep thought. I feel like that's a show, or like at least a video. It's like, do you want to understand what improv is? Let me explain to you. And like that thing, all of a sudden it's like you hear everyone's voices, you know, like in movies in the early 2000s when they were really excited about the internet.
Yes.
And they would like, there was, I can't remember which one it is, but it's like, there's a person on the street and they're looking at another person and they don't have a phone. They have like a screen in front of them that's like virtual, and they're looking at it. And when they glance at them, it tells them about this person. Like, it's like, this person likes tennis, and this is, you know, yeah, like, so that you can look at each person's details.
We will have that.
Like, that's very soon. Wild. Like the idea of that. I was like, maybe we will, but I mean, the idea that we can understand for sure. But, yeah.
But yeah, I think it's pretty, those big sort of thought experiments are really interesting. I was talking to a yoga teacher the other day, and I was saying, you know, sometimes I realize I'm going to die, and I don't realize it in a glib way like now when I just say, one day, Amy, one day I'm going to die. I can say that, and I'm not really feeling that loss or that absence or that sense that one time, at some point I will cease to be. But quite often for me, I do feel it, like absolutely understand that that's going to happen. And I can hold on to it for maybe 10 seconds before whatever guardrails in our psyche spring back up and go, don't worry, it's not real. And I was talking to a yoga teacher, and apparently that feeling of absolutely understanding your mortality is one of sort of the ways of thinking that some parts of yoga is actually trying to go towards. And I was like, oh, that's cool, because ever since I was tiny I've had these flashes where I know it. So yeah. I don't know where that came from. Well, yeah, this is a thought experience, these big ideas that are too big for your brain to contain, that it has to shut it down again after a while.
Yeah, but that's to bring us back to the thing we've been talking about the whole time. That's why we have these short snippets. That's why we have these finite moments. That's why we have improv scenes that go away.
Yeah,
we have these moments, and we get to live in it for a second, see what it's like, and then leave that moment.
On a larger scale, that's what our whole lives are like.
Sure. Sure. I mean, you know, we only have our own time, so like we view it in our own way. But yeah, like in the larger scheme of it, like how many millions of people have been alive? Billions. Like the idea of that, and they're full, as you mentioned, the varied lives, all the thoughts they had, all the millions of ideas. And even to bring it back to you as a child, all the stories that you just had in your brain. That's just what you were like. And other people, that's not the way they process, but they have their own inner life. And like, amazing, fascinating. Love it.
Yeah.
So cool. Sonder. Yeah, Sonder. I was like, you can't use it, but hey, maybe it'd be a good show.
Yeah,
it would. Oh my God. Chris, thank you so much for spending time with me, for being on the podcast, for chatting about these deep topics with me. I really appreciate you spending time and sharing with the audience.
Thank you. I've loved it. And yeah, as I said, definitely some revelations in there that, you don't get to talk about yourself for an hour very often, and it's a real gift to be able to have someone say, yes, I will. I'll listen and make beautiful points to the and notice things that you wouldn't notice yourself. Yeah, I feel like I've, yeah, there's some things there that I'll be thinking about. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Good, good. Thank you for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all of our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.